This is episode 378 of JumbleThink.
T minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to JumbleThink, where we interview dreamers, makers, innovators, and influencers all about their journey of turning dreams and ideas into reality. Along the way, we're going to share some tips on how you can turn your own dreams and ideas into reality, too. Our guest on today's show is Cliff Oxford. More about Cliff in a moment. Whether you're a new listener or a longtime fan, now's the time to subscribe to JumbleThink. Head on over to wherever you listen to podcasts, search for JumbleThink, and click subscribe. To make it even easier, if you head on over to jumblethink.com, you'll find links to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and more. So head on over, subscribe to the show, and never miss another conversation. Now let's join today's conversation. Hey there, friends. Welcome to JumbleThink. My name is Michael Woodward. I am your host. We've got a really cool conversation lined up for you today. Our guest is Cliff Oxford. And I am excited about this conversation because of his new book. It's called A Redneck Revelry, The Rationale for the Trump Phenomenon. Now, if you think this is going to be a super political conversation, it's not. This is a historical look at the last several decades and what led up to Trump and a lot of what we're seeing in politics, but also beyond politics in the world of economics, in the world of business and education. It is a wide, vast conversation. This isn't Cliff's first book. This is his third book. He has two other books, the first one called Lambs, Liberal Arts Majors in Business Society to Leaders. And his other book is called No Grow Exit, How Entrepreneurs Start and Finish Fast. He is not only an author, he is a journalist, and he's also worked in the world of academia. Oxford started, built, and sold two national brands, Oxford Center for Entrepreneurs, which sold to Advantage Media, Forbes Books in April of 2018, and STI Knowledge and Inc. 13 Country, which sold to Mellon Ventures. It's a fascinating conversation, so let's go ahead and join our conversation with today's guest, Cliff Oxford. We are sitting down with Cliff Oxford today. Cliff, welcome to JumbleThink.
Thanks for having us. We're always delighted to join, and I think here in Atlanta, it's going to be 72 today, so I'm excited to be with you, and I'm excited for the day.
I know there's going to be some listeners in the weeks to come as this comes out that are going to be listening, and they might be in the very north of the country, and they're going to be jealous of that 70 degrees, so I'm a little jealous today.
Can't be jealous of us in July when the humidity comes in, so it all equals out.
That's true. That's a fair call. I'm excited to be talking about your new book. It's called A Redneck Revelry, The Rationale for a Trump Phenomenon. I'm super excited about this book. We'll have links in the episode notes, so wherever you are listening, it is right there. I want to back up a little bit before we dive into this book and get kind of a foundation of who you are. You are a writer. You've written three books now. You blog for the New York Times. You're a contributor to Forbes. You had The Next Tycoon on CBS. You're the creator of The Morning Report. Walk us through your journey to becoming this. You research a lot. You explore a lot. What were the fundamentals that led you to this place?
Well, you know, it really all started, as the book says, on Swamp Road. That's where I grew up, in the Okefenokee Swamp in southern Georgia. The Okefenokee is exploration. I mean, you could explore in the Okefenokee for 10 lifetimes. I think the curiosity started there. And I left for college, which is very unusual, as I write in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe 1%. Most of the time you stay right there. And that's part of the culture, is you don't get out. A big part of my career was I started at UPS at 19. I left 10 years later at 29. And I had become national IS manager. And then I got to the corporate office. I didn't know what was wrong, but it wasn't right.
Oh, wow.
I was an entrepreneur. I was an entrepreneur put into a corporate environment. So I left and started a company, which was the early CRM.
Wow.
That's you know, we got some big accounts and we started growing and going from 100 to 300 to 400 people. Then the big guys got in and knocked us back a little bit. And then in that process, we had to readjust, and we did, and we became a dominant niche for the Fortune 1000 in our IT space. Mm-hmm. But I sold that after 9 years. Then I went to academia because I had gotten my MBA from Emory. I went back there, endowed a program, and academia was about as good to me as the corporate office was.
Wow.
It was just not a fit. But as while I was there, I started the Oxford Center for Entrepreneurs, which I sold 2018 to Forbes Books, but it was because I was basically bored there.
Wow.
And I started it, and we really focused on a niche, not startup. We really focused where it gets really dicey is when you actually got something to lose and you got to start expanding into other territories, other countries. Yeah. So we started looking at that, and I started writing a good bit about that experience. And then that led to the New York Times, writing for the New York Times, and then the three books.
Wow. I love that you were able to identify that something wasn't wrong. I think that if COVID hasn't highlighted anything for most people other than this, it would be still a win. And that would be that so many people are selling out for dissatisfaction in the places that they put themselves in, whether it's a job, whether it's so many different spaces. And the book, I think, highlights the dissatisfaction that's driving some of these things. And we're going to dive into that in a moment. You are writing a book from a perspective of both someone who has been in kind of the forgotten part of America and a person who has made themselves in what would be considered the arrival points, academia, big business, all of these things. You've lived in both worlds. So that perspective, that presupposition that allows you to view this, how did you reconcile that as you wrote, viewing from both perspectives, the conversation that's going on around this, what you say, 2.8 million people that are forgotten, the renegades?
Well, those 2.8 million people were the ones in 2016 that showed up at the polls and voted that hadn't been voting. And that was the people that was motivated by the Trump phenomenon. So these are not the people at the Republican Party. These are not diehard Republicans. They were in no man's land. They showed up to vote for him. That was a 2.8 million that definitely pushed him over the top. I've had to do that whole journey. The question you just asked, I had to do that. I've done that journey many times.
Okay.
When I'm in the elite of academia, I'm still the guy from Wakerock. And I think I write in the book, I have really traveled a lot in the world, let's say so-called elites. I would never be accepted. I could feel that I was never accepted in that world because of there's just this inherent connections. People who come from that world and stay in that world, they know each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And they know when the people who don't. That's not to say that I've got many friends in that world and had many great relationships, but I had to really help me see not so much Donald Trump. The book, by the way, is not pro or anti Donald Trump. It's what the climate that was created that gave Trump the opportunity to become president.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the perspective of both really helped me was looking at that climate.
Yeah.
And the conditions that created.
Yeah. What was the spark to want to write this book? What was that moment where you went, there's something going on here that needs to be discussed, and it's just not being, that conversation's not being had?
Well, it was every night listening to the media going, how could they vote for this man?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying their vote was right or wrong.
Yeah.
I'm just, the book lays out how they could vote for this person.
Yeah.
Because people that ask that question had really good lives. And actually, before Trump, the economics really helped them. And as I say in the book, it helped me.
Yeah.
But you're not looking at it from the perspective of the people that have lost so much in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
It's really easy to understand why they voted for Trump. I'll tell you, I just got a message yesterday from a 26-year-old. She read the book. She works in strategy. Comes from one of the elite schools. And she says, your book has changed my life. I will never look at a Trump voter the same again.
Yeah.
I was looking at them as total idiots.
Yeah.
And now I look at them a totally different way.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this in the book. You say, it happened in broad daylight because of the redneck fantasy that was sold. Today, most people still don't understand the sentiment or situations in the rural areas of the U.S. that make up 97% of the country's landmass. They don't know, sadly, that over the last 40 years, dreams have withered by the wayside, and in all the despair and now commonly death, that starts to be the rationale for the Trump phenomenon. And you go on further in there and you talk about the policymakers in Washington, D.C. and their perspective and what motivates them. What shocked me, you know, you heard time and time again on media that the reason that Trump was elected was it was a hatred of Obama. You heard people saying, well, this is a bunch of rednecks that are racist and all of these different things. And it seemed like those were the easy attachments that you could say, well, what defines these people? Let's just put it on there. But the more I looked into your book, the more I realized that this was something that had really, as you said right there, grown over a long period of time. It wasn't just a switch that was on. And I still don't think that a lot of people understand that.
No, and it had been going on for 40 years. And it was, and as I say in the book, it was very conscientious of saying, we cannot have a stock market if our wages are much higher than everybody else globally.
Yeah.
So they made some very specific policy changes to level the global playing field on wages. So, and they just made, in 1982, they made a decision, we can't have a person in Waycross, Georgia earning $20 an hour.
Wow.
And when somebody in China is earning one.
Yeah.
We got to get those two closer together. It was very conscientious. And a lot of the reason they say that is because they don't want to address the climate that created Trump, because the campaign contributors, and I'm talking about major league, global league campaign contributors, are not going to let you change that. So the Democratic Party, you know, they were having terrible times getting their campaigns funded until Ms. Pelosi's husband, who's on Wall Street, went to Wall Street and said, I can get Democrats to take our contributions and vote our way.
Yeah.
Then suddenly his wife becomes speaker. Hey, that's politics. That's the way it's played. But when they made that deal, they could no longer support fixing those climate conditions.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that I see over and over again, I am big about just being upfront about my biases. I am a conservative or lean conservative, and probably more in the moderate conservative space. I didn't love Trump. I didn't love any of our options. Definitely did not like Hillary from that perspective of the alignment there. And yet the problem seems to be that it's not a Republican issue or a Democrat issue. It's an issue of something bigger going on in Wall Street, something bigger going on in D.C. that is driving agenda on both sides.
Yes, yes. And by the way, there was plenty that the climate, I had a lot of problems with Trump. And so, like I said, the book was not pro-Trump or anti-Trump. I have a lot of problems with the Democrats.
Yeah.
The Democrats became as awful as the Republican economics, and they joined them. And that was the way both sides get equally funded now.
Yeah.
So the Republicans didn't have to become bad. They were already bad. The Democrats just had to join them. And I gave a speech the other day and said, we could have still, I'm a business person. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm on the business side of this. But we could have had a better economic outcome without the economic coup that was taking place in 1982, where you basically said, we're going to screw these guys over that's making $20 an hour.
Yeah.
And they got screwed. The guys got screwed.
Yeah.
that's a large part of what's driving the satisfaction, as you say. I would even go to say, believe it or not, underneath even Black Lives Matter. I would say underneath Black Lives Matter is an economic driving. Economics are driving why those people are in the street.
Yeah.
In many cases, rightfully so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kimberly Jones, who became the internet sensation, who did that, she and I have done a couple of events together. And I have said to Kimberly, if the hood and the holler are ever hooked up, this country would be changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's going to take the lead, the right leader.
Yeah.
To connect the hood and holler.
Yeah. And I do think that Trump tried to do that to an extent, started doing prison reform and some other things and tried to do it, but not. There were some weird things with Trump's campaign, especially this last year. And
I agree with both points.
Yeah.
I think he had an interest there of, hey, I want to help African Americans, and he wanted to economically help them, but he got weird on other things that unhelped them.
Yeah.
But he wound up doing both. I don't even think that's a word, unhelped, but his campaign unhelped several things.
Yes. Yeah. So I want to step back. I had a guest on 6 months ago, Ed Freeman. He wrote a book called The Power of And. He is a professor, and he, for me, this just reinforced what he talked about, which was the economic stacking that was going on with capitalism. And I'm a pro-capitalist overall, but taking and deregulation, stacking certain philosophies, shareholder philosophy is a good one, to say, what are the priorities of business? What is the priorities of Wall Street? And it really did start changing in the late 70s and early 80s. NAFTA is a part of this, as you mentioned in the book. Why do you feel like, was this a greed grab from these government and business leaders? Was this a philosophy of global economics? What was the driving force to really, because like you said, this was intentional. This wasn't just a, oh, we accidentally got here. There was a driving force on this. So what was their motivation in these changes?
Well, the U.S. market is the biggest economic market in the world. I mean, outside the European Union, which is so disjointed, maybe, it's the golden goose. The American market is the golden goose. So you got to look at it from their perspective.
Yeah.
There are folks with global holdings. They got global wealth, and they're watching it dwindle in the 70s. And they go, we got a problem.
Yeah.
We got the golden goose has got, it would be really a golden goose if we could get the wages down.
Yeah.
Wages are a problem. And you heard all this about inflation. Oh boy, inflation is going to wipe us out. And that was one of the excuses that was used. So they just, you got to get in their shoes. And this is huge global European money. This is global wealth in America. And the Waltons, this is at the Walton level. This is not the guy giving a $5,000, okay?
Yeah.
This is that level. And they say, we've got to fix this problem. And they went in and they jerry-rigged it with trade agreement.
Wow.
Now, I think we could have great global trade agreement. And I think that's I believe in that you got to have the bigger the market, the better.
Yeah.
But there's so many things they could have done to balance out. We could have actually brought China and the others up instead of letting them bring us down.
Yeah.
That's not what they wanted, obviously. So it was very intentional, and you're paying, and you know what? And the cost of this today is where we are.
Wow. So this leads on to other issues. You highlight several. There are two that I specifically want to make sure we touch on. How did what was going on then lead to the meth and opioid addiction? I worked at a church in Northern California for several years that dealt with the meth addiction in the early 2000s quite a bit. And so I've seen it firsthand. I've been on the streets with people. I've been in meth houses trying to get people out. I've seen that devastation. And then that leads to the opioid addiction. And how did the fundamentals, the foundation that was set in the late 70s, early 80s, begin to unravel and lead to addiction? They seem like they're separate issues, but they tie back together.
Oh, very much so. And they tie back to, you know, at the end of the day, humans are humans. Whether you're in a ghetto, whether you're in a rural area, if you don't have hope, without hope, people turn to, you know, addictions and vices, and we find the worst things to do.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what happened. I mean, I'll give you, when there were jobs there and you had to go work at the factory, everybody knew that you had to graduate from high school and you had to have a clean record.
Yeah.
That was a path. When that was taken away, when these jobs were taken away and hope was taken away, without hope, you turn to meth and addictions, no matter if you're in the Middle East or you go to terrorism and that sort of thing, or if you're in South Georgia, or if you're in South Detroit, South Chicago, you're going to go to meth.
Yeah. You say hope there, and I think that's a powerful word. I mean, that was the entire campaign of President Obama for his first election was, I'm bringing hope back. Trump basically had the same message, you know, let's make America great again. Let's bring hope. It's another way of saying the same thing. Is hope directly tied to economics? Are there other markers underneath it that build that hope? Or when we're talking about this in this context of this conversation, the hope that was lost was an economic security, a chance for a better day. What is that hope? How can we define that?
Yeah. And you know, as the book points out, of the 2.8 million, while many of them had only voted in one of the previous five elections before Trump, many of them voted for President Obama in the first election.
Yeah, yeah.
So that takes away a lot of the racism card. Racism exists, but it's not why Trump got elected. So they heard that message from President Obama.
Yeah.
And many of them went and voted for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, we live in a capitalistic system, by the way, which I think has no other economic system has gotten more people out of poverty than capitalism. It's the best system out there that I have seen, read about, or witnessed. But in capitalism, it does come down to money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the hope is coming, you know, I mean, yes, the answer to your question is yes. It is. You take away the economic dreams, and that's taking away the hope. I don't know if there was a movie that came out a few years ago called The War Room, and it was two brothers, and it was a film shown in all churches.
Okay.
But in this film, they actually indirectly criticized if you had economic ambition.
Okay.
And the brothers are two great brothers that actually are from South Georgia.
Yeah.
And I talked to them and said, you know, I think you can be economically ambitious and also have a faith.
Yeah, yeah.
You shouldn't have where that's the last thing we need down there right now is stepping on people's economic ambition.
Yeah.
I think the dreams here are that because I the smartest girl in my class, I went to high school with, grammar school with, she was extraordinarily talented, extraordinarily smart. And I saw her a few years ago and I said, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you know, I'm just sitting at home.
Wow.
And I'm waiting for God to come. We all are waiting for God to come. There's nothing wrong for that. We're all waiting for that.
Yeah.
But that was her only thing she was doing in life.
Wow.
And, you know, that's almost the opposite end of addiction.
Yeah.
That's kind of the scenario there.
Yeah. It doesn't stop there, though. It doesn't just stop at the addiction. One of the things your book pointed out, I looked over this graph in the book, and I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I'm like, this can't be. And that graph was a little graph about prices of food in Atlanta versus a rural city. And what shocked me, you talk about the food despair, in the change of diet in the South as an example there. But what shocked me was that if you went to the Piggly Wiggly, which all of us in America have heard of the Piggly Wiggly, if you went down there, prices were often a dollar more for the same product than it in downtown Atlanta, which to most of us, you know, I love cities. I had an office in Manhattan for years. I lived on the West Coast. Most of our clients were in Silicon Valley. And I think of higher prices. I think of this is going to cost me more there. And when I saw that graph and I looked at it, it just shocked me and how part of this is just so much on wines on top of each other. Why were prices vastly different between the two?
Well, also, yes. The reason is farming in southern Georgia in the South is not like it used to be. I mean, farming is a big agriculture.
Yeah.
Now, they used to be cheaper 40 years ago when there were more farmers there and more supply.
Mm.
But when you don't have economic dreams and hopes and people are on meth, you know, they're eating a lot of the wrong things.
Yeah.
So if Piggly Wiggly puts out lettuce, it's not going to sell as much as the frozen pizzas.
Yeah.
That's one thing. The second thing is, quite frankly, as I point out in the book, and food stamp recipients have really grown up high in those areas, whereas it used to be non-existent. You couldn't even find somebody on food stamps. And today, I think in some of the counties I showed, it's 38% of all people.
Yeah, yeah.
And look, I mean, I'm glad we have those sources for people who have food needs, but it's also people who are shopping like that are not as frugal as you would be if it was your own dollar.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry to say that. I'm not saying that to be, you know, critical. It's just a fact.
Yeah.
And what's even worse, as I point out in the book, what is worse than the Piggly Wiggly is these dollar stores that have popped up. And that is that's just predatory retail. It's taking advantage of people who have to live day to day.
Yeah.
And if you're buying things on day to day, you can charge a lot more than if somebody's going to Costco and buying, you know, the 36 rolls of toilet tissue, which I do, you know, because I'm saving a nickel per. If you go back to the climate that clearly occurred Trump, you take my wages from $20 to $8, and then you bring in, my retail, I'm paying 4.5 times more at dollar than it cost at Kroger in Atlanta.
There's no way to win in that.
There's no way to win in that scenario. That's called exploitation.
Yeah. So I want to look a little bit as we move towards the end of today's conversation to look to the future. I love that data can give us information that's factual and not emotional. You look at this and you say, here are the underlying current of what's going on here. This is the stack of failures that have happened in the business world, in the government, in so many different spaces that have built to this place where you have so many people disenfranchised by what's going on. We hear the Democrats say all the time, we're your savior. We're going to come in and rescue you. We're going to do this. We see the Republicans saying business is good. It's going to trickle down and it's going to be good for you. All of it seems like the track record from both sides is that they're not actually doing what's right for the average American. That year over year, for the last 40 years, it's just continued to snowball. So where do you see this 2.8 renegades? And I would guess that's probably actually growing during COVID. What is the answer for them? And how do we move forward?
In the last chapter, I put a solutions chapter in what we need to do. And I'm right in the middle of updating the book, What Happened and What's Next. And that goes directly into your question. The Democrats and Republicans are hamstrung by campaign contributors. And Wall Street figures it out. Hey, Washington is not hard to buy off.
Yeah.
We can buy that off and we can get them to vote our way. And I said in the book, a solution like in the rural areas, this is not about tax cuts or government programs.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is about massive direct checks.
Yeah.
And you got to have a New Deal type of structure that comes in, pours the money in, and you're betting the house.
Yeah. All in.
That is what's going to turn this around. And probably before that happens, I'm predicting in the next 10 years, not the type of insurrection we saw January the 6th. I think it will be a lot calmer, a lot more professional. But I think a group of Americans will go to DC and say, give me the keys.
Yeah. You mentioned big checks and jobs as what you're talking about there. That's what I believe you're referencing in the book. I've been struggling with, and maybe you can answer this. America was built on revolutionaries. It was built on people who said, we need a government that works for us. We need a system that works for us. That was the foundation of the Tea Party. This isn't right. What's happening isn't right. We need to retake this back. And, you know, people look at January 6th and what happened there was wrong. I'm not going to mince words. It was absolutely wrong. But there are reasons why people feel like the government that they know, the America that they love, the opportunity that was available has disappeared and the system is broken. So you mentioned this, there's going to be people who say, give us the keys. What do you think that will actually look like? What does that mean?
Well, you know, first of all, I think the January 6th, that particular group did a great disservice to a cause, to what could be a good cause.
Yeah.
And that is give us the keys.
Yeah.
Because the way I see it, the way both parties are competing for campaign contributions and getting funded by the same people, basically, you're not, that's going to really lock up any kind of change. I think with social media now, with podcasts like yours, with Clubhouse, you're going to have a organized group of Americans get together and say, let's go to Washington. And they're not going to storm the Capitol and hit police officers, but they're going to call for a change.
Yeah.
A revolutionary change. Give us the keys.
Yeah. So does that look like campaign finance reform, term limits, those kind of safety checks that remove the sheer amount of power, or is it, well, and lobbyists and the power that they have, or?
You're going to see, like, I put in the book, I think it was 12 things that would be asked for the change. You're barred from life from being a lobbyist if you're in Congress.
Yeah.
You're going to talk about some sweeping changes, like lobbyists are not allowed to congregate within 50 miles of Washington.
Wow.
Those types of wholesale changes, a complete stop to the retirement system for senators and congresspeople and the executive branch. So that, because what that does, that doesn't add a lot to the deficit other than it fleeces the system.
Yeah.
So I think you will see that in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Democrats are struggling with the minimum wage right now. And that gets back to 1982. The reason the Democrats are struggling with that, it gets back to 19. Are you going to let that genie out of the bottle again? Where wages go start going up.
Yeah.
So that's, I think you will see that in the next 10 years.
Yeah. 2022 is right around the corner, 2024, not far off. What do you see these renegades doing in the future when it comes to congressional reelections and the power of the House and the Senate, and then presidential election 2024? Who do you feel will fill that gap for maybe Republicans? And I mean, Biden is a wild card too. Can he go 2024 and run again? What does that look like?
Well, I think that there's bad news for Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, and everybody else trying to take on the Trump voter. It's a total personality driven. It's Trump or nothing.
Yeah.
And he's not going, nobody's going to inherit those voters.
Yeah.
If he decides to run, the nomination is his.
Yeah.
On the Republican side, but he very well may choose not to run, though I think he will definitely play it for all it's worth up to the last minute about that he is going to run. probably the smartest person on the Republican side is that Adam Zinger, who's taken a total opposite of Trump. Mm. You know, the congressperson from Chicago,
yeah,
that's opposing, that voted with the Democrats.
Yeah.
That's the only political oxygen left in the Republican room.
Yeah.
To be polar opposite of Trump.
Yeah.
So with Trump, if he's in it, if he's not on the ballot, they think the whole system is a wash.
Wow.
And they're not going to go back. They're not going to go to the polls. It's what happened here in Georgia with the two Senate seats. Without Trump on the ballot, those people did not go back.
Yeah.
You can see it in every precinct.
Yeah.
Outside of Atlanta.
Wow.
Voting totals went down.
Yeah. He was the authority that drew everything else out.
Everything else out. You know, in my business life now, I help companies buy and I help people sell their companies. And the one company you never want to buy,
mm-hmm,
is a personality driven company.
Yeah.
Because when you take that person out, there's no company.
Yeah. Yeah.
You take Trump out, there's no party.
Yeah. Wish we had more time to talk about the swamp and what that looks like. But I will say this. If you want to know about the reality of draining a swamp, it's covered in this book. And it's quite fascinating because I never saw it from that perspective. I didn't live in a swamp growing up. I lived in rural Pennsylvania. So to understand the reality of that and how that ties back to Washington, really good. I don't know if you want to call it an allegory or it's a good picture there of the reality of that. I want to make sure we have a moment to jump into rapid fire questions as we wrap up today's conversation. Before we do that, how can people find and connect with you? How can they find the book? How can they get it and read it?
Well, Redneck Reverie is on Amazon. You can Google it. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual places. You know, by the way, you pronounced it correctly, Reverie. Most people say Riviera. we do have a redneck Riviera.
Yeah.
but that's our Panama City beach.
Mm-hmm. I went to college in Pensacola, Florida. So
oh, did you?
Okay, I know that whole...
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, you're very familiar with it. But
as Reverie, we called it, Lower Alabama.
There you go. They can get in touch with me real simple. Go Cliff, CLIFF, at cliffco.com. That is CLIFFCO.com. Cliff at cliffco.com. Feel free to send me an email. This was my previous two books were business books. And this one definitely, like I said, I get comments from people reading it in China.
Wow.
And people are fascinated with the redneck culture.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of myths around it.
Yeah.
Which we try to clear up in the book.
Yeah. Really fascinating book. We're going to take a break right here. When we come back, it's rapid fire questions. I hope you're enjoying today's conversation with Cliff Oxford. If you are interested in this book, we are doing something really cool. We are giving away one free copy to one of our listeners. So how do you win a copy of this book? Head on over to jumblethink.com where you can sign up for our email newsletter, and that will get you signed up to potentially win a copy of this book. So head on over, subscribe to that newsletter, and maybe start reading this book. Now let's jump back into today's conversation. We are back with Cliff for rapid fire questions. All right. Are you ready for them?
Yes.
As a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
An astronaut.
What is one tip you'd give someone with a big idea or dream and they don't know where to start?
Go get somebody to write you a check for the product.
What is one change you would like to see in the world?
No campaign contributions for politicians.
Yeah. What do you want your legacy to be?
You know, I would want it to be, he tried it. He tried his hardest. He didn't always do the right thing, but when he didn't do the right thing, he went back and fixed it.
Yeah. What's one book you think every dreamer should read?
October Sky.
I'm not familiar with that one. That's the first time someone's mentioned that book on this show.
October Sky.
Nice. How do you define success?
It is fulfillment. Are you fulfilled? And I know that happy is such a used word, but fulfilled and content are the true happiness.
What is one trend you are currently excited about?
Grass-fed beef.
I love grass-fed beef. I just love beef. What is one thing you wish you would have known when you first started out?
Choosing a spouse is very, very important, and it should be done with a lot of care.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I could have used some pre-checklist on that one.
If you weren't doing what you're doing today, what do you think you'd be doing?
I could be in the Okefenokee Swamp, living there and probably, you know, working at whatever job, but taking advantages of what the swamp offers, you know, fishing, hunting, exploration. You know, with one or two different things, I could have very easily stayed.
Wow. And our final rapid fire question, what is one dream you're still wanting to fulfill in your own life?
You know, I just reached a big one. I'll say my two children, my son works at Peloton and my daughter at Stanford. So them gainfully employed is a bigger dream than I've ever had.
Wow.
And you know what? My one dream is that they just be happy. My children are happy. And that means that's a dream.
Nice. So we wrap up. We always like to leave the guest have a final thought. What would you like to leave all of us listening with today?
The one thing we have to do is learn to walk in the other person's shoes. And that means really understanding and going to where people live and going to talk with people, not what you hear on CNN or the news or what you read in a book. You know, go to South Georgia, go to these rural areas. I really spent time in the inner city. I really wanted to understand, you know, the urban neighborhood. So I think, and you know, I spent time in American University of Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
Went over there 6 or 7 times to guest lecture, and not only I did not understand the Palestinian Israel issue until I went to Palestine.
Wow,
I had to go to Palestine to really understand that.
Yeah,
and what I saw was not available anywhere. That viewpoint I saw firsthand was not available anywhere. So I would say not only walk in their shoes, but go where they walk.
I love that. Cliff, thank you so much for taking time out. I'm really enjoying the book. I can't wait to get the whole way through it. And I look forward to seeing how this all shakes out in the next couple of years. So thanks for taking time out and sharing this perspective that I think needs to be heard and seen right now.
Well, I think of all the interviews I've done, this was the one that had the most meat. And it really speaks highly to you that you got to the meat of this thing. And I really don't have anything else to say. I mean, you did such a great job. The rest of the book was kind of fun, but what we discussed here was the very core of the book. I thank you, okay?
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Once again, I want to thank Cliff for joining us here on Jumble Think. If you enjoyed today's conversation, or if it's challenged you to think a little bit differently about your assumptions, make sure to go check out the book and also connect up with Cliff. The links to the book and all that Cliff is doing is in the episode notes, so go check that out. Now I'm going to address the elephant in the room. I know some of you may have thought that this conversation was on the border of being political or inappropriate. I think the problem with a lot of the conversation going on right now is that it's based on bias and personal opinion. And those things are important to know. But it's also important to look at the historical context and the data that drives the conversation. It's important that we look at the reality and we don't just make assumptions about what we think about maybe politics, religion, about business, about each other. My challenge to you today is when you have an opinion, a bias, a perspective that is purely based on emotion, maybe take some time to step back and dig into the data, dig into the stories that are outside of your story, dig into the facts that drive the reality. It's in this place that we can find understanding. It's in this place that we can learn the truth. And it's in this place that our biases get changed. Now, not all biases are bad. Some of them are really good and healthy. But when we cling to these biases, often we bury ourselves in falsehoods and lies. And that's not what we want. That's at least not what I want. And I hope it's not what you want either. So take some time to think about today's conversation, to check out this book, to take and reflect on yourself. What are the things in your life that might be not completely true, that might be holding you back, that might be biases, and challenge them. Maybe you'll find out you're right. Maybe you'll find out you're wrong, but nonetheless, you'll be better informed and well equipped to have conversations of truth and not just assumption. I hope today's episode has challenged you and pushed you to think differently. Thank you so much for tuning into today's conversation. It means the world to me that you would listen. And my hope is that you would take some risk to push into the things that are uncomfortable and to chase those dreams and change the world around you. Les enfants peuvent également prendre un moment revitalisant dans quelques mois lorsque vous aurez bien saisi la technique et que vous serez maître de votre corps. Vous pourrez vous décontracter même en travaillant.